Well, good morning. We weren't here last Sunday. Actually, it's been 3 weeks since we're here, and it's nice to be back with you. But I understand last Sunday my dad mentioned something about a close call that I had several days before that. Their mercury vapor light, yard light, wasn't working, and he wondered if I could come out and change the sensor. We got his long ladder and set it up. Now, long ladders can get a little wobbly, and I'm a little out of practice. So we set it up close to the guy wire. That's that cable that comes down at an angle and anchors to the ground to keep the pole from bending. Then I held onto the guy wire as I climbed and kept my hand on it when I got to the top. Now, I'm not a big fan of getting shocked, so when I got up there within reach of the light, I did a pretty thorough examination of the maze of wires that was coming to that pole. I didn't see any that were exposed. I didn't see any broken insulation. So I reached up to grab the arm that the light was attached to. I never even grabbed it. As soon as my hand touched it, my fingers, my muscles seized, and it clenched my hand to the arm. And, of course, my other hand was still on the guy wire, and I couldn't let loose there either. I've heard of this kind of thing happening, but I'd certainly never experienced anything like it before. There was absolutely not a thing to do except holler for Dad to come and turn the power off. Bless his heart, he scrambled as fast as he could to get it turned off, but he wasn't right at the mains, and so it took a little bit of time, but it felt like a very long time. And I had enough time to wonder how long I could last like this. My muscles were spasming, my eyes couldn't focus. And I also had time to wonder if I would have control of my muscles once the power was turned off. I didn't know whether I'd be able to stay on the ladder or not. That was 20 feet off the ground. Well, obviously the story ends well. Dad cut the power and I was able to hold on, and we narrowed down the problem to a short in the light fixture itself. It didn't trip the breaker because the arm was mounted on a wooden pole. And except for being weak and a little spooked, I was all right. Now, I'm no expert on electricity. I know others have experienced something similar and survived. I also know that given the right conditions, it doesn't take nearly that much current to kill someone. But would anyone here quibble with me if I said that God spared me? Now, since I don't have exact data on the voltage and the amperage, etc., that I was experiencing, I'm a little cautious to use the word miracle to describe what happened. But as I reflected on it, the only conclusion that I can come to was that, like every other experience that I've ever encountered, both the enemy and God had a purpose, a plan for the event. And I don't know exactly what either one was in this case, but I know that God determined that it would fit his purposes better for me to live. Well, some of you are rolling your eyes inwardly and thinking, come on, Arlen, give up. It was a miracle. What's your problem? Well, good question. Probably the main reason that I'm not exactly sure, probably the main reason is that I'm not exactly sure how to define a miracle. Another reason may be that it's a controversial issue and I'd rather step gingerly around it. Do any of you identify with that? Have you ever been uncomfortable with someone who either poo-poos miracles or someone who seems to make too big a deal of them? Maybe some of you are tempted to say, I just don't know. I know that sending a rocket to the moon isn't a miracle. I know that turning on a light by flipping a switch isn't a miracle. And I know the resurrection of Jesus Christ is a miracle, but I don't know what about the stuff in between. Or maybe you're the one who has figured it all out, and you get impatient with us, those of us who haven't. You know exactly what a miracle is and what it isn't. You know how God uses and doesn't use miracles. Or maybe you're somewhere between those positions. Even if you're not, I think there is a decent chance that that we can understand miracles a little better in the next section in the Gospel of John. Next sections, actually. I'm entitling this message, John's Take on Miracles. Now, that's just a touch misleading because I'm only looking at the first at the first miracle in John today, but it is the first look of how John views miracles. John makes a big deal about miracles. Do you know what word John uses exclusively to refer to Jesus' miracles? Well, it's the Greek word semion, which actually means sign. There are other Greek words for supernatural occurrences, and the Synoptic Gospels tend to use those words that focus on Jesus' power or his mighty works. But John chose to use semion, which places the focus squarely on what these demonstrations of power pointed to. They are signs, and that's the word that he uses. Now, the King James frequently translates it miracles, but the majority of the other translations translate the word semion as signs. Some of you may remember my little illustration at communion about getting stuck in a snowstorm, and then when we see the hotel sign, we huddle up to it. You remember that? What was wrong, if somebody remembers it, what was wrong with the illustration as I gave it? What just didn't make sense? Yeah. Here was blowing blizzard, we just walked a half mile, and we huddle around the sign instead of going to where the sign points us. And I think that can really apply to the issue of miracles as well. And I think that's part of why John uses this word. John is extremely careful in each account to give each account as a sign pointing to something else. So that brings us to a little review. Who can tell me how many signs John chose to include in the gospel?
Seven.
Exactly. That comes straight. Well, okay. Let me back up a little bit. He included seven signs. Now, can you tell me how he chose those signs? This comes from what is often considered a key verse in the book. Say that again. That's right, that ye might believe. And that actually is a quote right from John 20, verse 30. Therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Now, I can just imagine, having prepared a number of sermons, I can imagine that John was going through this catalog of signs and thinking, man, I hate to cut that one out. Boy, this really should be in there too. But he narrowed it down to seven signs. Let's rattle them off quickly. And if you need to open up your Bibles to do so, go ahead. The first one you know you probably know where we're going on that one. What is the first one? Water into wine. That's in chapter 2, and that's where we're headed this morning. Let's keep going. Feeding the 5,000. That is in chapter 6. Yes. Healing the nobleman's son. That's at Capernaum, and that's in chapter 4. Healing the impotent man, that's in Jerusalem. That is recorded in chapter 5. Let's see, I think we've got three more. The raising of Lazarus, right? That was in Bethany, John 11. One that happened on the water. Jesus walking on the water, John 6. That was in the Sea of Galilee. And one more that happened in Jerusalem, and this got Jesus in a lot of hot water. That's right. So, there you have it. Whatever we get out of these signs, if we fail to come away more convinced that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, then we've simply missed the point. Now, the next logical question is, how do each of these signs point us to the deity of Christ? How do they glorify Christ as God? Well, we can approach this from a variety of angles, but Leslie Newbegin takes us back to chapter 1, verse 14, in the prologue. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. He says that these signs point to, I quote, the present reality of the gracious rule of God. I like that. The present reality of the gracious rule of God. N.T. Wright says it this way: the whole point of signs is that they are moments when heaven and earth intersect with each other. The point is not that they are stories which couldn't have happened in real life, but that they are stories which point away from earth to a heavenly reality. Miracles glorify God. Let me say it differently. Miracles glorify Christ as God by revealing both his divinity and his humanity. That's how John portrays them. So with that background, let's go to the text. It's John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. I'm reading this out of the New King James. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you to do, do it." Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." And they took it. When the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. And he said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now." This, the beginning of signs, Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. As I've said before, I believe a major key to understanding a passage like this is to understand what the original author, writer, meant to convey and how his original audience would have understood it. To that end, I was looking for details about cultural practices of the Jews or other Middle Eastern cultures around the time of Christ. And it took some time, some digging, but eventually I found what I was looking for in a massive book written in 1963 by a Brit. His name was J. Duncan M. Derrett. It's entitled Law in the New Testament. It's a fascinating book, and I've requested that we get it for the library. Derrett has done a remarkable job of compiling the data. Derrett says that in this culture, a wedding was hosted by the bridegroom and or his parents. This meant that they not only took care of inviting the guests, but also assumed responsibility for entertaining and feeding them. Now that becomes particularly significant in light of the fact that wedding feasts lasted for a minimum of 3 days, and if it was a first marriage, it lasted for 7 days. Derrett says that this was a time for festivities and included plenty of intoxicating wine. Derrett further tells us that the Jewish groom would have invited basically two kinds of guests to his wedding feast. He would naturally have invited his close friends and relatives, and then he would have invited other acquaintances. Some of these he invited as an act of charity, like poor neighbors, but these would have been kind of set apart from the rest. Others he invited out of courtesy, like distant relatives or business associates. Then he would also invite locals with clout, with influence, like a rabbi or the ruler of the synagogue or someone with political or economic power. Now, there was a reason that the poor neighbors were set apart from the rest of the group. The expectations for them was different, and they wouldn't necessarily have expected to be treated as well as the honored guests. Derrick goes on to say that the Jews paid a great deal of attention to rights and duties and had very clear guidelines regarding relationships and interactions like those at a wedding feast, even down to what the value of the guest's gift should be and how well the groom's family should expect to feed the guests at this 7-day feast. Get this. If the groom and his family failed to feed their guests appropriately, his penalty was not just shame. The guests could actually file a civil lawsuit against him. This detail comes out in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the written version of what used to be the oral law of the Jews. It started in Ezra's time. A rabbi named Judah the Prince wrote it down to preserve it in the 2nd century BC because, well, there were many scholars and rabbis being killed, and he feared that the oral law might be lost. And only the Torah, our Old Testament, is more authoritative to Jews than the Mishnah. That's how high they value it. The Mishnah is an extrapolation of the Mosaic law, the kind of thing the Pharisees would have quoted, filling in minute details to respond to every conceivable situation. Think about the IRS tax code to give you an idea of the level of detail involved here. So here is the Mishnah quote. It's actually in the context of settling an estate after the death of parents. If some of the brothers had bestowed gifts as groomsmen in the life of their father, when the wedding gifts are reciprocated, they revert to the common funds of the estate, for the reciprocation of wedding gifts may be claimed through a court of law. If, however, one has sent to his friend jars of wine or jars of oil, he cannot claim them through a court of law because the presentation of such gifts are mere acts of loving kindness. That was the law of the Jews. Now, we shake our head at such strict protocol, but do we avoid this completely in the expectation of our culture for weddings or graduations or whatever? Sorry, that's off track. Let's get back on our track. Back to the issue of reciprocation. Did you notice that if the groom had attended your wedding, you were bound by law to give back to him at his wedding a gift of similar value? Now, remember the poor neighbors who were invited? The groom might not have attended their wedding, so they weren't expected to bring as much of a gift, but they would have been expected to bring something, probably in the form of food or wine. Now let's move on to Mary's involvement. Bob Deffenbaugh points out that John doesn't say that Mary was invited. That probably means that she had some inside position, possibly as a relative. She also had the authority to tell the servants to do what Jesus said, which Derrett thinks indicates that she was probably helping the bridegroom's mother with food preparations. Here is what Derrett says. She was evidently on terms of intimacy with the bridegroom's parents and was behind the scenes enjoying the festivities in the more dignified, though not less festive, atmosphere of the inner apartments. She, together with the other women, would be much nearer to the domestic quarters and would become aware sooner than the male guests in their dining room of the situation with regard to the supply of food and drink. End quote. John tells us that Jesus also was invited with his disciples. Merrill Tenney sees in this wording a hint that Jesus and his disciples were invited out of obligation, probably because of Mary's close connection. But some scholars think that as a rabbi, he would have been an honored guest, invited to add prestige to the event. Now, I'd like to help us grasp this event a little better. So in a little bit, I'll need two female volunteers, probably from the front three rows. I'll give you a little more background first, and then one of you who is brave and bold, just grab the person beside you or in front of you and come up here. And if you're not brave enough, then I can always pick you. It really won't be scary. I just want to help you do a little role playing, and then tell me how it feels. So you already know the story, but let me help you picture the setting a little more. You're in Cana. It's an obscure, tiny town in Galilee. You are a servant. You may be working temporarily for the host family, roughly like the equivalent of a catering service, or you may be a regular servant of the family, but in either case, you have no social standing, and you are probably even poorer than the family that has hired you. You are on your fourth or fifth day of this wedding feast, and you have been pushed pretty hard keeping up with all the food preparations and serving. Already yesterday, you saw that the wine supply was running low, and you expressed your concern to your master. You said something again this morning, and you are starting to suspect that the reason nothing has been done about it is that there is nothing that can be done about it. There just aren't any options left. You know it shouldn't bother you because it's not your responsibility, but you also know the grave implications of not meeting the guest's expectations. And if your master's family gets even more strapped financially, you might lose your job. One of the ladies who is a friend of the family comes from your neighboring town of Nazareth. She generally has been staying close to the kitchen and has graciously helped out when things got a little hectic. As you send out the last pitcher of wine, she overhears you telling your co-worker that this is all you have. The next thing you know, she has signaled the family's young son and sent him into the men's dining area to call out her own son, a rabbi who also came with his disciples. Now, you are glad for your help, but you know the way of rabbis, for his help, but you know the way of rabbis, they aren't people with deep pockets. And you know he's already brought enough food and drink to cover himself and his disciples. But when he comes out, his mother tells him about your dilemma. And his response surprises and puzzles you. He respectfully calls her ma'am, as though she weren't even his mother. Then he says, in essence, your concerns aren't my concerns. You think, is this getting us anywhere? Now, let me introduce you to your surroundings. You are standing in a little room off the kitchen with an opening onto the backyard and a gutter that catches the water after it's been used for ritual cleaning and then directs it outside. This is a busy room. The servants and the food preparers are constantly bustling through it, and before every meal, all the men file through here to do their dutiful ceremonial washing. It's nothing too big for the rabbi with his disciples crowding around him, and you squeeze against the ritual washing jars, 21st century stone jars here, to let another servant pass with a tray of refreshments. Okay, we're about ready for the action, so I'm ready for two volunteers.
Okay.
Now, after that two-sentence interchange with her son, the helpful lady pokes her head into the kitchen and addresses the whole crew, "Do whatever he tells you." Then she heads back into the ladies' quarters with nary a backward glance. The questions are still bouncing around in your head, but you don't have long to wander. The rabbi glances down at the water jars and then tells you and the others to fill them. More questions collide with the unanswered ones in your mind. But since it's been a day or several since the jars were refilled, this is going to take a while. And so you grab the pots there, and you head for the cistern in the backyard there. You can't see it. It's in the floor. And you start making your round trips. The cloth there is to help you strain the cistern water as you dip them into your jar, so you can start making your round trips. Now, one by one, you're getting the jars full. But the rabbi doesn't stop you, and so you keep on dipping, straining, carrying, pouring. These are big jars, 20 to 30 gallons. Finally, all the jars, all six, are completely full, and you and your co-workers pause and look at him expectantly. In your mind, you're still wondering what maybe extra cleaning ritual or he is going to ask for that would require this much water. And then he drops the bombshell. He points to your wine pitcher and tells you to fill it from these jars. And take it to the master of ceremonies in the men's dining room. You gasp, glance around at your co-workers, and look back, hoping desperately that he is looking at someone else. He's not. Now, let's hit the pause button there. What are you feeling? What are you thinking? What are those questions that are careening around in your head? And you out here aren't exempt from answering either.
It feels really crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he sending us in there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any others? If you know anything about wedding feasts, you're probably checking to see if he's drunk. But he's not. He's clearly rational. You're probably also thinking, surely he saw that this water came from the cistern. Surely he knows that it's not fit to drink even as water. And even if it were, you're probably thinking, what will the MC, the master of ceremonies, do when he samples this stuff and it's not wine? And you shudder, don't you, at what kind of a scene that would make? Or, even worse, what if the master of ceremonies is distracted and tells you to go ahead and start serving the guests? What a fiasco. Where will it end? Thanks, you can be back. Appreciate it. Now, obviously, we can only speculate on this, but I've tried to recreate the scene as accurately as I could based on the study I've done. And I'd like to remind you that this was a real event and that there were real servants and a real master of ceremonies and real guests and a real dilemma. It wasn't life-threatening, but it was real nevertheless. And Jesus performed a real miracle. Now, back to my earlier premise. Miracles glorify Christ as God by revealing both his divinity and his humanity. What do you think? Did that happen here? I see some nodding. Let's keep going. By the way, do you want a picture of how much wine Jesus provided with this miracle? Let's do the math. If you would put this in 2-liter bottles, like our pop comes in, you would have at least 225 bottles and up to 340. That should keep you going for a while. Now, while we're on this topic, I imagine that many of us have asked, was this wine alcoholic? Did it have the capacity to make people drunk? It's a fair question. As nearly as I have been able to tell, all the internal evidence and the historical data point to the answer being yes. If you want more detail, check with me afterward. I wanted to include it, but there just wasn't time. Now, I'd like to go back and highlight a few details by way of a take-home here. Let me start with saying that Jesus not only attended this wedding, but got involved far beyond the standard compulsory gift. And that tells me that he approves of celebration. He is pleased to be invited to our birthday or graduation parties or to our weddings. Let's not forget to invite him. As far as I know, he doesn't get anything out of the food, but he does want and deserve the position of honor. And he will make your celebration a success if we're willing to define, to embrace his definition of success. If we're uncomfortable with seeing a celebration as a holy event that Jesus would grace with his presence, then I suggest that either our motivation or our perspective is twisted. By twisted motivation, I mean that we are probably wanting the wrong thing out of the celebration. Things like personal honor or prestige or self-gratification in food or in relationships. I've been guilty of pursuing all of these. It makes me sick to think of how often in my younger years I interacted with a girl at a social event, either alone or in a group, for selfish reasons. There are God-honoring reasons, I know. But, you know, we all have a real bent for selfishness when it comes to relations, to relationships. If we aren't comfortable with having Jesus at our parties, checking for this problem is probably a good place to start. Regarding our perspective being twisted, I think sometimes we get the idea that Jesus wouldn't laugh or get excited at our celebrations. Consider this Jewish wedding. Do you think Jesus just sat back in a corner, aloof and withdrawn from the festivities? I'm confident he wasn't doing anything self-serving or saying anything unnecessary. But I just don't think that he was just sitting there watchfully like a policeman on duty. If he were physically at your son or grandson's birthday party, do you have a hard time imagining him tying a balloon to his leg and joining in the balloon stomping game? If you do, then are you saying he wouldn't approve? If so, why would you have that game at your party? If our motivations and our perspectives are right, we should be supremely excited about having Jesus attend our celebrations. He may just choose to bring glory to himself by revealing both his divinity and his humanity. On a related theme, Jesus specifically endorses weddings. I don't think it was mere coincidence that his first miracle was at a wedding. A persistent theme throughout the Old Testament prophets is the picture of God pursuing his people as a suitor pursues his beloved. That theme continues in the New Testament with some of John the Baptist's comments in John chapter 3, and it reaches a glorious climax in the figurative language of Revelation. Here's one example from chapter 19. Then I heard what seemed to be the voice of a great multitude, like the sound of many waters and like the sound of mighty thunder peals, crying out, "Hallelujah, for the Lord our God, the Almighty, reigns. Let us rejoice and exult and give him the glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his bride has made herself ready." Every time Jesus sees a godly wedding, I think his heart leaps with joyful anticipation. Sometimes soon it will be his turn, and never has a more eager, devoted, passionate suitor waited for his bride. Can you believe it? That's us. And we, his bride, will drink in his revealed glory. I'd like to return now to some of my earlier comments about miracles. Let's jump back to Mary's comment to Jesus and his mysterious reply. First of all, Mary is to be commended, I think, for simply having presented the situation to Jesus. She didn't tell him what he needed to do. She just told him what was wrong. And she appropriately told the servants to follow Jesus' instructions. That's helpful. We make a mistake when we tell Jesus how he should fix our problems instead of simply presenting the problems to him. But there must have also been something in her expectation that these words themselves don't convey. Many students of the Word have weighed in on this question, but the interpretation that makes the most sense to me of Jesus' response has three parts. First, by saying that his hour had not yet come, he was at least telling her that the time wasn't right for him to go public with his miraculous power. He may also have been referring to the hour of his glorification, which, you know, from reading later in John, always refers to his passion. Secondly, his use of the term woman to address Mary seems to be a way of saying, "I'm no longer your little boy. You can't expect me to act on your desires. Our relationship has changed." But perhaps most importantly, when he used this strange-sounding Hebrew expression that is literally, "what to you and to me." It's used several times in the Old Testament. I think he was telling her, and is telling us now. As Kenneth Boas said, "He will act in his own way. God will act in his own way. He will not come to our beck and call in the way we might expect. He will act for his own reasons. He will act in his own time." End quote. God isn't a miracle vending machine. If we get too insistent about seeing a miracle or any move of God, I think we are at risk of forgetting who is sovereign. A good number of us have been praying for closing on the school property over here, Pleasant View Academy, and we've struggled with frustration over the senselessness or seeming senselessness of the delay. Every week that passes, decreases the chance of the grade school moving before next fall. I haven't been troubled by the way I've heard anybody pray about this, but I suspect that we've all been tempted to pray something like, God, why don't you do something? Or, God, you need to act soon. And we've probably all found ourselves in those kinds of situations, haven't we? The truth is, only He knows what He needs to do. Only He knows best how to reveal His glory. The key word here is sovereign. Think about it. At a fundamental level, isn't any miracle simply an evidence of God's sovereignty? He is deciding which laws take priority. We usually see it as natural laws being overridden, but it is up to Him to override whichever of His laws He chooses. In my introduction, I talked with the struggle of defining a miracle. I accept that we will always have some difference in how we define this, but the truth is that even with a pretty broad scope of definitions for miracle, one statement will still be true. And this is not quite a quote, but the idea comes from a book in the church library by Adrian Rogers. And it says essentially this: if you don't believe in miracles, then you are going to have a very difficult time believing in the sovereignty of God. In the light pole incident that I told you about, I say with deep conviction that God was sovereign. I know this opens up that whole host of questions that we've all asked ourselves at some point or another, some more than others. And I don't know where to go with all that. But if a miracle is nothing else, even if we fail to see how it reveals God's glory, if it is nothing else, it reveals God's sovereignty. Now here is my clincher. John calls Jesus' miracles signs. Look again at verse 11. Jesus did this, the first of His signs in Cana of Galilee, and revealed His glory, and His disciples believed in Him. Let's look at that last phrase first. Jesus didn't make a big splash with this miracle. Presumably, His mother, the disciples, and the servants were the only ones who found out about it. So, what did He accomplish? His disciples believed in Him. Why? Because He revealed His glory to probably a half a dozen new disciples. Here is a poignant quote from Bob Deffenbaugh. We wrongly think that if the glory of God is present, it will be in some dramatic display of power, one that is visible and spectacular, one that is seen and acknowledged by all. Let me remind you that the glory of God was manifested in this miracle, even though few recognize it as such. So did God accomplish His purposes at the wedding in Cana? Yes. It didn't have to be a big show. He simply revealed both His divinity and His humanity. And this revealed His glory, and His disciples believed in Him. If we are trusting Jesus, we will see His glory revealed in ways that the rest of the world will often miss. As Adrian Rogers says, believe in miracles, but trust in Jesus. Let's kneel for prayer. God of wonders beyond all galaxies, You are holy, You are worthy.
We offer you our praise. We gladly confess that you are sovereign, but we want to trust you. Lord, this week, help us to be listening to you. If you're telling us to do something, help us to do it. And anytime you choose to reveal, Lord Jesus, anytime you choose to reveal your either your humanity or your divinity, we want to have our eyes open to see the glory that you're revealing by doing so. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, certainly thank you, Brother Arlen, for pointing us to Jesus as we